Well, welcome to Week to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California from Monday, February 8th, 2016. As Mike just explained to you, this is our 113th birthday of the Commonwealth Club itself. It is...
Sure, come on.
Yay for us. It's also the fourth anniversary, by the way, of Week to Week. And before you ask, where were we for the previous 109 years or whatever, we were getting prepared. So we're finally here, and this was the week in which the dating app Tinder had to cancel the accounts of women who were using it to spread the gospel of Bernie Sanders to prospective dates. I assume you had to like swipe far left or something in order to get it, but they were kicked off. So you're safe if you go back on Tinder. Thanks for joining us here today in San Francisco. I'm John Zipperer, your host for Week to Week and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. On today's program, we're going to talk about, naturally, the presidential primary season, which is underway, as well as Super Bowl protests, Mario Woods, Barbara Boxer's Senate seat, and other political news. We always note that the Commonwealth Club of California is a place for people of a wide variety of views, so any opinions that are expressed are those solely of Deborah J. Saunders and not of the Commonwealth. solely those of the speaker, that's what I meant to say.
There you go. There's one.
Okay. Speaking of which, let's meet our panelists today. I'm going to start on the end there with Deborah Saunders. Deborah J. Saunders is a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, where she's also the token conservative blogger at sfgate.com. She's on Twitter at Deborah J. Saunders. Next to her is Joe Garofoli. He has grown up right before our eyes. When we last saw young Joe, he was a political reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. As of January, he is now the senior political writer at the Chronicle, so congratulations.
Thank you. Congratulations.
I'm sure now he'll come out of his shell and feel freer to share his opinion. Anyway, he's on Twitter at Joe Garofoli. And next to me is Carson Bruno, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, where he specializes in California politics and policy. He's on Twitter at Carson J.F. Bruno. So there are question cards spread throughout the room, of course. Write down and submit your questions. I will try to ask as many as possible during the program. Now on to our roundtable. Usually we've been starting with the Republicans because they, frankly, are more entertaining and interesting this year. But we're going to start with the Democrats right now. And Deborah, you recently wrote that after the Iowa caucuses last week, quote, Republicans know they've got a healthy chance of getting rid of both of their general election nightmares, meaning Trump and Cruz. Democrats have no such luck. What do you mean?
Well, Hillary Clinton has her baggage and Bernie Sanders has his. Hillary, well, we're seeing it right now with what's going on in New Hampshire. It's just like 2008 all over again. Democrats just can't wait to get away from her. Not all of them, but a lot of them are just, they don't trust her, they don't like her, they're really unhappy with her vote on the Iraq War.
Still?
Well, that was a big factor in 2008, sure. And I think it sort of goes to the way that they still feel about her now. So you've got a sizable chunk of Democrats who aren't really happy with her. And then you've got Bernie Sanders, the socialist Democrat socialist. I don't know. I get it mixed up. And he's someone who free education, $15 national minimum wage, that's more than double what the minimum wage is now. Barack Obama couldn't get a $12.10 minimum wage through, and I can't imagine it's good for the economy. Many election years, people talk about the Republicans being out of the mainstream. It's the Democrats for 2016.
Joe, what do you think about that, considering especially the Republican lineup that is at or near the top of the polls for the Republicans?
Well, I think that some of the things that Deb points out was that I want to start with that. Iowa showed Clinton's weaknesses. I mean, and also, in addition to what you're talking about, young people are still not into her. I mean, she lost young people, was it 75 to 10 or something like that, and other young people didn't care. So that's going to be a big problem. Because she needs young voters to come out in the fall to have a chance. In terms of what else we learned from Iowa, we learned that on the Republican side, we learned that Donald Trump is something that he really hates. He was a loser. And what we saw after that is we're all curious, how is he going to behave when he's not, the other night at the debate, says, I'm going to win. Well, when he didn't win, he started saying, well, no, let's have a recount. This didn't happen. Somebody cheated. It wasn't presidential looking.
He was gracious for 2 minutes.
He was gracious for the first few hours afterwards.
Yeah.
And then by the next morning, he's sobered up and returned to his traditional demeanor. So that's what we learned there. And we also learned that that Bernie Sanders, well, he did very well. I mean, to tie Hillary essentially in Iowa. You know, Iowa, you're campaigning there for many, many months, and he's not going to have that luxury in other states. It takes a long time to pull up an operation all over the place. And so we'll see what happens. He's going to win. He's very, very likely to win tomorrow in New Hampshire. And then we'll see what happens. South Carolina's tough for him. And then the southern states, which start rolling. And then we have Nevada, which will be very, very interesting to see. And then the southern states, which is going to be a tough slog for him.
Before I go to Carson, I keep hearing that Nevada's going, you know, lots of eyes are going into Nevada. It's going to be really heated. Why? I mean, what is it about Nevada?
It's a caucus state. So he can, the way that sort of an insurgent campaign is better, it's a better measure of enthusiasm of a campaign. You can get a lot of people out there. You convince people in the room. There's a lot more energy to it and a lot more of a fluid dynamic to it. The other thing is that the challenge for him is that there's going to be a lot of, or for both candidates, is Nevada is the swing area. Las Vegas is the swing area. And there's a lot of union workers, people who work on the Strip, and right now the major union there is likely not going to endorse. So all those voters are up for grabs, and that's what's going to be really fun to watch there. And I'm heading there next week, so that should be fun.
Okay. Carson, what did you learn from Iowa? What stood out about the results there?
Well, to echo what Joe was saying, I mean, yes, the Bernie showed that he has enormous strengths amongst young voters, mm-hmm. amongst white liberals. Which plays very well in Iowa, New Hampshire, starts off the whole shebang. The problem for him is that he struggles with older voters, with the more moderate, somewhat liberal voters, and with minorities. And that's a big problem for him going into most of the Democratic primaries, because who votes in Democratic primaries? It's older voters, much like the Republican primaries, it's older voters as well, but minorities. So I think it was problematic for Hillary that she lost, or sorry, that she essentially
she won by
she
20,
tied, yeah,
20,
she tied
25%.
That was a loss. That's a loss in my mind, because she needed to come out strong to show that she could win a white liberal state, and that really I think gave her not as much momentum going into New Hampshire, unlike she had in 2008. Yeah, she got third place, which was a huge surprise in 2008, but she really hunkered down and really went into New Hampshire with an enormous amount of momentum. That was kind of unusual, which allowed her to pull out that surprise victory.
And she played to win this time in Iowa.
Yes,
She had people in every precinct in Iowa. She spent $9 million in campaign ads.
Yep.
And she spent time there. Like you could, she kind of kissed it off.
Yeah.
Somewhat. She was a latecomer to it 2008, but this time she played to win, yes. And she still didn't crush him.
It shows she has enormous vulnerabilities that have not been dealt with yet, and you're starting to see that. I mean, they're already talking about completely reorganizing her campaign after what's to be an expected loss tomorrow.
And they can't even wait till the loss to tell everybody that they're going to get rid of some of the people.
It seems like they've just kind of given up and kind of thrown up their hands and moving on to South Carolina, which isn't a bad strategy to come in, kind of tamp down the expectations that she's going to lose, because she doesn't have to win New Hampshire, because technically Bernie's a home state guy there. Vermont's so close that... ideologically and geographically, that doesn't really matter. But she needs to kind of tamp down expectations, because she's running into a wall similar to what she did in 2008. The one difference is Bernie has really shown no interest in actually winning the nomination.
What do you mean by that?
He hasn't really gone on the attack. He hasn't really tried to position himself with minorities, knowing that he has to win minorities in order to win enough states to win enough delegates. He's really just focused on the issues about trying to pull Clinton as far to the left as he possibly can in order to kind of win an ideological battle in the nomination.
Deborah. May I say something? So Hillary, the thing is, though, you can see how tight the campaign is right now, how tightly wound they are, because you have Madeleine Albright saying there's a special place in hell for women who don't help other women. You've got Gloria Steinem going on Bill Maher and saying, well, of course young women voters like Bernie Sanders, that's where the boys are, right? Feminist icon. And then Bill Clinton actually called the Bernie bros sexist. Mm-hmm. Yep, Bill Clinton called someone else sexist. So I think it shows a certain kind of desperation on the part of the campaign.
Yeah. They are scared. I'm not going to say that. They are scared because this could easily
South Carolina to look to next.
It could easily flip, and they're not really paying attention to it. But I don't. Bernie's not running the sort of campaign that makes me think he wants to win the nomination. He wants to make an impact, a statement.
You could see it in the last debate where he pulled his punch, where she called him out for the smear campaign, which is what he was. It wasn't that enough as a smear campaign, but he's kind of trying to, you know.
Negative.
He's trying to say something negative and go at her. And she said, hey, you have some innuendo, bring it. And he didn't.
Yeah.
Now, anyone else, it wasn't quite the Tim Pawlenty, you know, whiff from several years ago, but it was, he had a chance to do it and he didn't. And that's, you know, if you're a Bernie supporter, I would have been a little bit disappointed. Yeah. Well,
speaking of Bernie supporters, one of our audience members asks, if a large number of people who don't usually vote for Bernie Sanders, won't that mean he isn't out of the mainstream, that is, if he wins? Does that increase the pool of voters?
There's not much evidence to suggest that. I mean, voters are coming out in droves. People who weren't voting voters before are coming out in droves now to vote.
So turnout overall isn't...
No, it's nothing. It's up a little bit. It was up a little bit in Iowa for Democrats. It was up a lot in Iowa for Republicans.
It was up a ton for Republicans. Yeah,
but nothing. Really? You're not seeing the level that kind of the Obama coalition pulled out in 2008 really suggests that he's really kind of converting non-voters into voters.
But if a lot of people do come out and vote for him, yes, it does show he's mainstream.
Yeah. But it hasn't happened yet.
Yes. Yeah. But if it happens, yeah.
Well, let's go into the New Hampshire primary. It is tomorrow. The polls have been batted about numerous times through every day. You know, who's up a little bit, who's still strong, et cetera. Stay with you, Carson. What do you expect to have happen in New Hampshire in both parties?
Well, I apologize to the political journalists here, but don't listen to polls. Don't read the polls. That the polls have shown themselves in the past few cycles that they have no clue what's going on.
So you think Martin O'Malley could stage a comeback?
There is a distinct possibility. No, okay. That's not going to happen. The polls are correct there. but especially in a situation like we're seeing in New Hampshire, where you have five, maybe six candidates on the Republican side clustered so close together that trying to say, oh, Rubio's ahead by 2 points and Cruz is down 4 points, they're all within the margin of error. It's all statistical, you know, it's all statistical blah at this point. What you really want to be looking toward is kind of who has put the ground game together.
Get out the votes stuff.
To get out the votes, yeah. The people who are actually on the ground trying to get their people to the actual polling places. It's not as necessary in a primary state like New Hampshire as it is in a caucus state where you really need people to show up at the right time and stick it out and stay there for hours sometimes. But you still need people to show up. So that's really the kind of focus.
And what do we know about who has the good ground games? I mean, that's...
Well, Bush has a great ground game in New Hampshire. Kasich, Christie have both great ground games. They're kind of, they've made that their Alamo. If they don't do well there, they're dead. Politically speaking.
Yeah. They've had 60, I think those two have had the most visits to New Hampshire. Yeah. And the thing is that where Rubio might be looking good in the polls, he's running sort of a campaign that's based largely on his charisma and his message and his age.
Yeah.
And it's not so much the infrastructure yet to back it up. I think those two guys might be, you're totally right. Plus, throw in the fact that, 35-40% of the voters there are nonpartisan, they can vote either way.
Right.
And we don't know if they're going to vote for Democrats or Republicans, and it's supposed to snow tomorrow, too. So
we'll get the snow vote.
No, yeah.
What I've been watching is, so you've got we know Trump is probably going to do well, and we know Cruz is you know, came in first place in Iowa. So you've got the four establishment lane, they call them candidates, right? Rubio he slipped in that last debate. All of the Beltway pundits said, this is it, because Chris Christie sort of punched him for using that sort of robo kind of answer that he gave. I don't think it really hurt him that much. I think it's a wake-up call for him that he better up his game. Kasich is a natural for New Hampshire. He's got that kind of, I'm a Republican, but I don't really like Republicans' crustiness that I think plays there. And Christie.
That's a terrible bumper sticker.
Yeah, I know.
As a Republican, but I really.
He's the John Huntsman for 2016, yes. Right? And Chris Christie has been fascinating to watch because he did do a great job in that last debate, smacking Rubio. I don't know how much he helped himself, but he did sort of, he did show he could bring it to Hillary. I mean, if that's what people are looking for. Now, I figure Kasich and Christie can't both do well. One of them's got to go. And then, of course, there's Jeb Bush. Now, Jeb Bush is supposed to have a good organization. He brought his mom, right? and he did better this last debate. And I think New Hampshire, just as Vermont is next to New Hampshire, so is Maine, his second home. So I think that has to help him. So, you know, we'll see. Maybe he can surprise people. But this should soon come down to a three-man race. Right.
I think, I mean, Carson is out after this. Maybe he'll try to hold on to South
Carolina. I think
he'll
stick around. He's got some cash.
Fiorina is going to be out. So, I mean, there you're probably going to lose two within the next 2 weeks. And the real question is kind of the Chris Christie, John Kasich. And remember, John Kasich is running really the Huntsman model from 2012. John Huntsman got 17% in 2012. So if he can just basically resecure all those votes, 17%, when you're looking at a field as fractured as it is, that's an impressive number. It got Huntsman third place. But
and he's even more of a tax cutter and more of a union basher than Huntsman is. So he's slightly more Republican than Huntsman. He's way more Republican than Huntsman.
Yeah, but he's playing that same
ballpark. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, if it really comes down to kind of who is in order and what order are they in when it comes with Bush, Christie, and Kasich. Yeah. And it's going to be very hard for Kasich and Christie to continue on if they don't get in the top three, maybe top four. They might have an argument if Cruz is kind of lumped in there. But it's going to be an interesting one to watch. I think Trump will underperform his polling.
Let's hope so.
I think so.
We're rooting
it's not
just rooting against Trump. It's rooting against the pollsters.
Yes.
So like that's two reasons to hope that's true.
I really
or it could be rooting against Trump too.
No, it says both. It's rooting against Trump and pollsters. Yeah.
But I think that debate didn't hurt Rubio. I think it stopped his momentum. He was starting to tick up coming out of Iowa. Things were looking really good for him. It looked like he was going to pull away from the pack, secure a second spot. I think that momentum really kind of stopped.
Let me ask, how many of you saw the GOP debate this weekend? Quite a few.
I love you.
God, I love this crowd. It's always the best. Always the best. Yeah,
impressive. I mean, I've been amazed because, you know, political debates, and there have been 1,000 of them, it seems, this in the past 12 months or since June or whatever. And yet, these things have been big ratings bonanzas. I mean, is it...
Even without Trump.
Even without Trump, the one that he boycotted. Is there more? I mean, obviously, we're talking about a group with people who come to a political roundtable, political professional.
I was paid to watch.
Weirdo puts on political roundtables himself. I mean, but is there a wider interest and a higher interest at this time of the election season, or is that just I'm seeing it only from one angle?
So who knows what debate is next?
Democrats.
Yes, and when is it?
Thursday.
At 3 a.m.?
What a group. What a group.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's where?
Can we bust out the chocolate early for him?
They're always 6 o'clock. Okay. Or except for Saturday was 5. But they're almost always at 6.
Yeah.
Okay. This audience knows. Yes. Okay. I'm just going to ask a question that just came up because we were going to talk about this anyway. What about Michael Bloomberg? There is talk about him jumping in. My question is, what constituency is he going after? I mean, is it kind of between the Republicans and the Democrats? Is he trying to go for a slice of the old Republicans? Is he trying to go for the right of... I mean, I genuinely don't know. What are your thoughts, Joe?
His stance... Look at some of his... Okay, so he's pro-choice. He's pro-same-sex marriage.
Anti-soda.
Anti-soda.
Anti-gun.
But he's a Republican, but he's going to run as an independent, or he was last a Republican 8 years ago, 9 years ago. But he's also a Democrat before that, and he's been an independent, and he's run.
Sounds like Trump.
Yeah, he's kind of. But at least he's actually held a political job, and he's run the biggest city in the country, one of the biggest cities in the world, and he's been successful at that, and he's balanced budgets, and that's a great question. And I think the bigger question is, he said, I'll spend $1 billion of my own money to run, which is largely what the other campaigns are going to be spending. Yeah. But it's not just about spending the money. There is no nationwide Bloomberg network of supporters, other than his media network. So almost like a Berlusconi model he might be running on. He would be. I'll be probably shot by tomorrow for saying that. Who's going to help him? A political party. You know, people are running away from them. Political parties, but political parties actually do help you in stuff like getting out the vote and getting volunteers and blah blah blah. He doesn't have that. So, and he's basically going to run a startup operation. He's going to decide by March. So he's going to have six, 8 months to do this. That's a huge lift. Mm-hmm. To do.
And he says he wants to do it if it's Trump Sanders. Well, I don't think it's going to
you won't
be
know
Trump's. Yeah. Well, yeah. And it's not clear that it's going to be. And I sort of have an issue about this. Like, imagine if Rupert Murdoch decided to run. Now, he's not a natural born American, but somebody who's ahead of a big media operation. Bloomberg politics is a big force. Yeah. And I just sort of wonder how that would work, too.
Right. He might pull really well. If he jumps in, he might get to Ross Perot numbers in 1992. But his problem, though, is the Electoral College. I mean, there's no way for him to clobber together a majority, so he'll deny someone a majority. That kicks it to the House of Representatives. They vote as state delegations. Who holds majority of the majorities of state delegations? The Republicans.
And Paul Ryan.
You're going to get a Republican president out of that one.
Paul Ryan.
I mean, so it just seems very odd that someone as smart as he is isn't thinking about those sort of very technical things. And he ought to be. I mean, he probably is. He's just...
Well, I mean, do you think it is... I mean, he's put a lot of money and effort into the gun control debate. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's what he... In the sense that you're saying that you don't think Sanders expects to become president, but he wants to make these issues front and center for the Democratic Party. Do you think Sanders would do it really just to ensure that...
Maybe
gun violence, gun control, gun issues gets talked about.
Very inefficient, not cost-effective way to kind of yes. push your yes. policy
yeah,
du jour.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot more.
Sure.
But there's a lot better things that he could be doing with that sort of money.
Absolutely. If you have $1 billion you spend on your own vanity campaign, and no third party is really, even Teddy Roosevelt, didn't do very well in that. But and to bring it up to California, someone who may be really hoping Bloomberg doesn't get in is Gavin Newsom and the people who want to put a gun control measure on the ballot in November, because if Bloomberg jumps in, the NRA, who is already going to play big in California, are going to have a nationwide effort against Bloomberg, and that's only going to turn up the heat on this state initiative here.
Okay. Carly Fiorina, you mentioned, was not in the last Republican debate. Why was that? Was that strictly on polling, or...?
She didn't meet the criteria threshold that they put together.
So she was the lowest polling of them?
Well, it was but it was done before the, I think they agreed to the terms before the Iowa caucuses, and then the game changed and people dropped out, and she would have qualified, but they already agreed to the criteria beforehand, if I'm remembering this correctly. I think it was BS. I mean, one other person, my God, they've had 55 people on stage before.
Well, and that it's getting smaller.
And the optics aren't good for the Republican Party either, just to exclude the one woman.
Well, yeah, also the network, I mean.
And the network, too, yeah. I mean, they could have squeezed the network. It was a bad look all around.
Okay, I'm reading this question.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we know
absolutely.
That. We understand that.
Yeah.
We understand.
Yeah,
it had to do with when they did the cutoff. Someone asks, will young people and undecided women Democrats wake up and realize that Sanders is not electable and not fall into the trap of, quote, the perfect is the enemy of the good, unquote? In other words, Hillary has flaws, but she can beat the GOP. So thank you, Madeleine Albright. any comments?
I'll go out there on a limb and say that depending on who the Republicans nominate, Bernie would probably have, you know, maybe a 40-60 chance at winning. Now, if it's a Rubio on the Republican ticket, then I mean there's a no-go. But if it's a Trump or Cruz, then it's a battle of kind of the most partisans bringing out your base. And someone like a Bernie, who really fires up his base, could give the Republicans a run for their money. Now, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but it could plausibly occur.
If it's a Trump or Cruz, do you think it could swing one of the houses of Congress, which otherwise I think nobody expects to change?
Congress, no.
No.
Senate, maybe.
I think there's a theory that having Trump on the ballot really helps Republicans running for re-election to get into Congress, because that there'll be big turnout. There'll be a lot of Republicans turning out, so that.
I don't know if those characters have very long coattails at all.
Okay. Jeb Bush recently, did you see this? He finished a speech before an audience. Was it in New Hampshire?
Yeah.
And there was dead silence, and he actually said, please clap. Now, when I originally was writing up some notes for this program, I said, so is it time for Jeb to get out? Because I'm on a first-name basis with him. Is it time for Governor Bush to get out? The polls that Carson tells us not to pay attention to, Jeb Bush is doing pretty well in them right now. I saw one just before we came in here, put him in second place. Now, there are lots of polls around. In New Hampshire, this is.
That was a gasp from the audience.
No.
Wow. The interesting thing about New Hampshire on the Republican side, and I don't know if it's the same on the Democratic side, but they have a 10% threshold. And so for delegate allocations. So anyone under 10% gets automatically no delegates, which is basically just kind of a give me to the person who's at the top or the top two. There's a chance where you might have, you know, 5-6 candidates that are above the 10% threshold at this point. And Jeb and the Governor Bush in the aggregation of the polls is right on the cusp there. I think it's going to be, he has the money to continue on right now. The problem for him is, I think fundraising will dry up immediately if he doesn't meet a 10% threshold.
In the pressure. I mean, there's a lot of pressure on him already to get out and endorse Rubio.
Really?
Or it could be Kasich, or anyone. It could be, but the point is that, a lot of people look at the party and think a Trump candidacy or a Cruz candidacy would be really bad. It's better for this third person, the third challenger, to come out ahead. And if does Jeb Bush want to be the guy who was just sort of sulky about Marco Rubio and his people were running all these negative ads besmirching Marco Rubio and hurting it? Or does he want to have a legacy of being sort of the godfather who blesses the young pup, the young whelp who dared to get into the race.
His super PAC still has about $80 million in the bank, and so he could live off of that.
Yeah, but does he want to? Republicans are furious at Mike Murphy, who's running that super PAC, for doing so much damage to Marco Rubio. A lot of Republicans are really unhappy.
Well, it just goes to show you that money isn't everything in politics.
Yes.
Because the Jeb campaign has spent upwards of $100 million already, and his campaign has really gone south, not north, when it comes to the polling, when it comes to just the general consensus that he's going to be the nominee. Well,
and Trump was correct, I think, in that he nailed him for the low energy thing, and that really resonated. Yeah. When you see him, and now every time I see Jeb Bush, I think low energy. You know, it's like almost like his Chiron right there, Jeb Bush, low energy, and it really cut the knees off of him, and he's so tentative in the debates and on the trail. And the thing with John, what he said on the please clap thing, if I don't know how many saw that, but when you saw it, it definitely would play better in the room. You're like, oh, please clap, you know, huh? But it was really kind of very dry sense of humor, something you might say in an intimate gathering like here. But if you saw it on video, it'd be
please
like,
clap.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, someone actually asked the question you kind of just answered, Carson. How much does the poor performance of Jeb Bush deflate the fear of the power of super PACs? So it's interesting. Jeb Bush today just came out and made the comment that he would do away with Citizens United.
Yeah.
He thinks he's going
well,
to the
Supreme
Court.
Well, the answer to that question, though, is zero. I mean, it would not do anything.
No.
I mean, it shows, what, like Carson said, that money isn't everything, but it's nobody's going to say, oh, well, we should just not have super PACs.
But this election in its entirety has really also shown, though, that super PACs aren't all they are made up to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of, you know, Rick Perry, Scott Walker, Bobby Jindal, they all had super PACs that were well financed.
Yeah.
And what they realized was you can't operate with just a super PAC that's well financed. You have to be a functioning campaign also.
Right.
And I think there was a lot of kind of dogma around super PACs to begin with, because they're the new thing, they're scary, they're undisclosed donors, there's millions of dollars involved. But it really goes to show you that if the candidates aren't capable themselves, you can have the most best finance, the best operatives on your super PAC, and doesn't really matter.
And you can control your own message.
Yes.
You know, the campaign controls its own message.
It's huge.
You know, supposedly, there's no coordination between the super PAC and a campaign. So the super PAC can go out and say all kinds of crap, like Bush's is doing with all the other, with Rubio and the other candidates. But, you know, that is no substitute, as you said, for promoting a positive message and your own message for your own campaign.
Many months ago, when Carly Fiorina first entered the race, and it might have been you, Deborah, who said this. If not, I apologize. It was another panelist then.
Was I right?
Well, no. What the person said was
yes.
What you or somebody said
was
that she's not running for president. She's likely running for cabinet or vice presidential pick. And someone from the audience brings that up again, and that she, assuming the Democrats do nominate Hillary Clinton, she would still be a potent part of that team. Do you, first of all, did you say that? Second of all, do you still think is she viable as that, considering her performance? Does she need to stay in a certain amount of time how does that play into her post-candidacy viability?
Yeah, I did say that. I do, but, you know, I don't see her being picked as a running mate. She just didn't catch fire as much as people might have liked. You know, she was a great surrogate for McCain in 2008, and she was hoping he'd pick her to be his running mate. He, you may recall, chose someone else. So I think that, but you know, she can get her name out there. There are other things that she can do, but I don't think she got what she wanted out of the race. Mm-hmm.
No. She doesn't have a state. She doesn't have a constituency.
That's right.
Yeah,
she left California.
So, yeah, see where
she lives.
She lives
in Virginia.
Yes.
Especially because there are very capable other Republican women out there. Nikki Haley, the South Carolina governor, who only increased her political stock with the Confederate flag issue that occurred in South Carolina recently. Susana Martinez, mm-hmm. but some people do say she's a little bit Sarah Palin-esque on the national stage. But there are other options there if they want to go the female route. They don't have to go to Carly Fiorina.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if she makes it into a cabinet somewhere.
Yeah.
So,
well, before we move on from presidential races, take a moment to mourn the loss of Rand Paul, Rick Santorum, and Mike Huckabee, all of whom dropped out. Were any of
and
those a surprise?
Martin O'Malley.
Don't
forget Martin O'Malley.
Well, the news is that
the Democrats
he was
did, but that's not.
Any surprise in any of those three, or were they all kind of expected if they didn't show in Iowa, they would be out?
I was surprised a little bit, not that he dropped out, but that Rand Paul dropped out so soon.
But he's running for re-election, so.
Yes.
Yeah,
he had to keep
a primary challenger on. I think Martin O'Malley on election night was wishing he were Lincoln Chafee. Because who wants to be that 1% vote getter who's robbed Hillary and Bernie of that 1%, however it worked out. So Lincoln Chafee envy, Martin O'Malley.
I'm surprised Rick Santorum dropped out, to be honest.
I would have thought
he was gonna hold it off and try to keep on going and catch fire in some other caucus state. But
because losing didn't seem to bother him.
No, not at all. And then he turned around and endorsed Marco Rubio, which I found equally as surprising.
And it was a terrible endorsement.
It was that too. Yeah.
Well, there is that.
Maybe it wasn't an endorsement.
For those who missed it, went on Morning Joe and they said, "Oh, well, tell us why you like Marco Rubio. Can you tell us some of your his accomplishments in the Senate?" And he's like,
And they're like, "Well, that was a softball sandwich, question, sandwich, so where do we go from here?"
No. Which has now made it into a Jeb Bush campaign ad, coincidentally enough. So
they got money to burn. You know, why not?
Okay. Well, let's talk about the big game. Did anyone here, while the week or two beforehand, did any of you visit the Super Bowl fan city or whatever it was called? Quite a few.
This is the most active group of people ever. You guys do everything.
They're voting. They're watching debates.
They're watching
debates.
They're
going to the football things. This is great. Well, so it came and went, and the extravaganza known as Super Bowl 50 has left its mark. Okay, I'm reaching for text. I don't really know.
A big mark.
Yeah. We're not going to talk about the game or who won, because naturally I don't care. But a number of constituencies took the opportunity to protest around the Super Bowl thing. And actually, that's kind of my next question. Those of you who went, did you notice any protests? Yeah, you know, you did?
Were you protesting?
A few? Yeah, were any protests?
We were at the thing down at the Embarcadero.
Yeah. You didn't agree with it, or you couldn't tell what it was?
Well,
I
thought somewhat inappropriate.
Okay.
You saw what coverage of them on TV, you saw when you were there.
Yeah, Joe, you talked to folks who, and let me read your lead, and you were saying, San Francisco leaders were worried that wealthy tourists would be freaked out by all the homeless on the streets or frightened by any number of street demonstrations, but many tourists either didn't see them or shrug them off. What did you find?
So
when you
I was at the Super Bowl yesterday writing about it, not game stuff. And that's why I was just talking to people here and write about their impressions of San Francisco and what it was like, and were they freaked out by the homeless? Were they, you know, did they see any protests, you know, when they come back? And people were like, "Oh yeah, I didn't see it," or they're like, "Oh yeah, I saw it." And, okay. People the people from Denver, who are from Denver, they're like, "Well, we do live in a big city. We're not coming here from South Dakota, and where we don't see anything." But we, you know, so we see homeless on the street. We see some demonstrations, and the people who saw them were like, one woman told me, like, I didn't quite know what they were protesting, but my friends from here explained it to me. So there was that, and then the
that was a protester who said it to you.
So there was those actual money-paying tourists. But these are people who are like, you know, they're here for the Super Bowl experience. They're paying, you know, $3,000-$5,000 for a ticket. They're staying in the high-end places. They have sort of an insulated San Francisco experience. You know, their idea of a great excursion is like, "Oh, I went to Fisherman's Wharf." We're like, "Oh, okay, sorry to hear that." So that's what they didn't notice, which is bad news. It's good news for the city and the city boosters, but it's bad news for all the constituencies who are trying to get their message heard. They didn't resonate, at least with the people I spoke with yesterday.
Okay.
The one that really flopped was the Uber strike.
There was an Uber strike?
There was an Uber strike yesterday. The bunch of the drivers were trying to get together to try to demand better payment from Uber. Completely flopped. The New York City one seemed to have gone a little bit better, but still not as effective as they were hoping it would be, which is not surprising. I mean, if you see your Uber driver striking, why don't you just get on the app and drive yourself and make some money out of it? I mean,
One of the criticisms of the Super Bowl has been that it's a playground for the super rich. It's, you know, the people who are getting the tickets, of course, are spending these obscene amounts of money. But the fan city, or whatever it's called, Super Bowl City, I mean, I saw lots of people heading downtown and via BART and Muni who did not look like millionaires or billionaires. I mean, they looked like office workers and mechanics and waitresses who happened to have a replica jersey and wanted to go with their family and see it. So, I mean, I kind of wonder if... It's not my thing, but you know that maybe so the cynics should maybe set aside their cynicism a bit. You know, people had fun there.
And it was I went there with my wife, and I'm a huge NFL fan, as you know. I love my six-time champion Pittsburgh Steelers. Okay. Yes. Any Steeler fans, anybody?
Yeah, right here.
Oh, no, there we go. So, but I found it to be a lot of waiting in line for stuff that was not all that great. It seemed like a huge gallery of corporate marketing. You know, oh, Kaiser has a huge tent. Oh, what are you doing there? I don't know. You wait in line for 35 minutes. I don't know.
Did they take care of brain trauma injuries?
Yeah, that's what they should have been doing. They should have just been showing films of people with head injuries. But it was, I don't know. I was underwhelmed, and actually a couple of people I talked to from out of town were underwhelmed. They enjoyed the NFL experience, which you pay $35 for, or $25 for. If you had a little kid, I thought it was cool if you had a son. Or a daughter who wanted to, was way into football, and that would have been fun to take them around.
I was surprised more of the cities around, particularly on the peninsula and closer to where the stadium actually is, not in San Francisco, that they didn't do more stuff. So I live in Mountain View. Mountain View has a VTA stop right there that connects with Caltrain, one of the biggest kind of commuter routes to get from San Francisco to the actual stadium. And Mountain View did nothing. You walked around, it was just like any other day, any other Sunday, any other Saturday. And it just seemed very odd that it seemed like San Francisco was into it, and then at the stadium was kind of into it, but then everywhere else was kind of like, whatever.
Yeah. I did start on Santa Clara, the city, what they were trying to do. But it's like they're 45 miles away.
Right.
And I mean, you know, while Alicia Keys was playing and, you know, the Metallica and all that, they had like Hart and Huey Lewis, with all due respect. And those are not A-list bands anymore, you know. So but they're going to have this huge development, they're trying to get a huge development in Santa Clara. So when they bid for the next one, that might be there. And there might be more of a there in Santa Clara. Yeah.
Well, I have to note that the Commonwealth Club has a very important connection to the Super Bowl. Our former art director is now an artist here in San Francisco, and he worked on the Puppy Bowl set.
I love the Puppy Bowl. I watched the Puppy Bowl.
I will add, while we're on the Super Bowl on a topic.
Sat with my dog. And
something Santa Clara did do correct, though, was get reimbursement agreements
with
the NFL. Yeah,
that's right.
So the $4 million that they spent on incurring the cost for the game will be reimbursed, unlike San Francisco, which decided they didn't need those reimbursements because you're flush with cash, apparently, up here, that you guys don't need to be reimbursed for the costs.
Yeah, they're out $5 million.
Yeah, yeah. So that's something that Santa Clara did do correct when it came to the game.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's talk about a range of other political issues, and let's start, Carson, with your favorite topic, the race to succeed Senator Boxer, and there have been some developments lately, so why don't you bring us up to date?
Okay, so we all know that Barbara Boxer is retiring in 2016. There's a smattering of applause there. So it's a race basically between right now Kamala Harris, our Attorney General, Loretta Sanchez, Congresswoman from Orange County, and a smattering of Republicans. Right now, we learned this evening that Rocky Chavez, a state assembly member from the San Diego area, has decided to withdraw from the race. So now we're down to just two former California Republican Party chairmen.
And this was at a debate. Debate was at 5 o'clock tonight. Wouldn't it be great if all debates started like this, where a candidate says, "I'm getting out,"
right, and walks out the door.
And then just leaves.
It was great.
But basically,
that's what Carly would have done had she shown up.
Yeah, so. Maybe. But basically, the big question mark over this race is, will it be the first intra-party top two under the new top two primary system? Will it be two Democrats going on to the general election in November? Because what we have here, we have now two kind of credible Republican candidates, the two former chairmen of the Republican Party, Duff Sundheim and Tom DelVaccaro. But we also have I counted 14 other Republicans who have filed with the FEC. Now, they all may not actually end up running, but they all are thinking about running. And so if you get 14 kind of no-name Republicans and two serious ones, the math becomes very, very hard, given the fact that it'll probably be around 40% Republican kind of vote turnout in the June primary. It becomes very hard mathematically for a Republican to coalesce the votes necessary to move on to the general election. So it could end up being a battle between Kamala Harris and Loretta Sanchez into November, which creates an interesting, it'll be an interesting thing to watch because it's the first time that it will have happened with a new top two primary.
So, Carson, if you were a Republican, would you vote for a Republican or would you vote for Loretta Sanchez?
Oh, dear. This is being recorded. I don't know if I should say
it. It is. And so everybody here knows Kamala Harris, our attorney general. She's the hottest attorney general in the country, according to the president. And she really has like the right look for a Northern Californian, right? Loretta Sanchez, she's really Southern California. Joe Matthews wrote this great column about that. And she's sort of, she's not that sort of professional, polished look. She's also known for somebody who gets a lot of things done. But she said things. She said some things that aren't really politically correct. So there are Republicans who are looking at this, thinking, Kamala Harris gets in, you're never getting rid of her.
And you're creating a rising star in the Democratic Party.
Exactly. And then Washington loves Kamala Harris. I mean, all those the donor class in Washington. So if you are a Republican, and what would you do? Would you vote for Loretta Sanchez, hoping for mischief? Or and of course, Loretta Sanchez, Latina, versus Kamala Harris, who is black and East Asian.
So I don't think so, because even though it would be fantastic to have Loretta Sanchez in D.C. rather than Kamala Harris, she still is very far from where the Republicans want their candidate or their senator to be. So I find it very hard to that there will be a lot of strategic voting in June. Now, if it gets to November and it's the two of them, then yeah, I see not large turnout amongst Republicans in November voting for the Senate race, but enough that it could easily sway the election toward Sanchez.
But don't you think this is also what the top two is designed to do? Not necessarily two people of the same party, but if those two who are liberal Democrats by really any stretch of the imagination, or by any categorization, they are going to have to appeal to Republicans, and so they're not going to go out there with super crazy left wing stuff. They'll have to deny the super crazy left wing stuff they said in the past, but they're going to have to moderate their views to appeal to all the Republicans voting.
And if Sanchez is elected with, even anecdotally, the help of Republicans, then that means that she is still kind of on the hook to Republicans in the state as the U.S. Senator in D.C., which means she needs Republicans to help her with re-election every year.
And she's worked with Republicans before.
Yeah, she has.
And I mean, you say a liberal. What is it she said about like 10% of Muslims?
I think it was 20, she said.
Yeah, would like to engage in jihad. So, I mean, she's sort of been known to say statements like that. So, and Kamala Harris just is not used to dealing with Republicans at all. I mean, it's not in her playbook. So
Kamala is a very weak front runner also.
Yeah, and she really is.
She's burning cash like crazy.
Not here.
Her burn rate when it comes to fundraising is absolutely horrendous for someone who hasn't even aired a campaign ad or even done a campaign mailer, campaign-wise. She's burning through money it's no other day. I mean, she's flying private or in private jets or in first class. She's staying in the Waldorf whenever she's going to New York. Like, it's just crazy expenses that she's acting like she is going to just walk right into her D.C. office. It's very odd.
She's had a campaign reshuffle before Hillary.
Yeah.
Right, she did. Yeah. But she still has $4 million in the bank.
She does.
Twice as much as Loretta and the Republicans. Like Duff has $70,000. Yeah. I was like,
but I mean, $4 million is not a lot in the state.
No.
I mean, it takes $10 to $20 million to really run a credible campaign. She's not well known despite being a two-term attorney general. John Chung, who is our current state treasurer, beat her a number of votes in the 2014 election, even though he was running for a brand new office and she was running for re-election. So there are vulnerabilities there that a Loretta Sanchez could easily take advantage of. It becomes very difficult for Republicans because they have fundraising challenges. Like you mentioned, Duff's the best campaigner, but also fundraiser out of the group. And he's struggling bringing the money because donors just don't want to give.
And again, there are a lot of donors are thinking, and Republicans are thinking, the Republicans don't have a shot.
Right.
And that's the thing he really has to fight more than anything. Yeah.
So they want to focus that money onto the state assembly races that are important to maintain keeping the Democrats from winning the two-thirds majority, and the Senate, state Senate seats, the congressional seats. That's where a lot of the donors are focusing their attention in California, which really inhibits a statewide nominee for the Republican Party. We saw it in 2014, two very credible candidates, Pete Peterson running for Secretary of State, Ashley Swearingen running for state controller, just could not get the money to run a functioning campaign that they really could have easily actually end up winning. I mean, those races were very close.
They were close.
They were, so, yeah. And they were great candidates.
Right, right. So okay. It's a struggle.
Well, let's talk about something even more local, though it's a national topic. San Francisco supervisors recently unanimously declared Mario Woods Day. This was in memory of the man who was shot to death by police. He had been wielding a knife, was shot multiple times by multiple officers. Joe, what would have happened if this, would that have happened, do you think? Would the supervisors have made this a city thing if there hadn't been so much national attention? I mean, this
well, the videotape was everywhere, and it's very difficult to watch. And I think they felt the need to respond to the community concerns about that. And the politics of this are very interesting because Ed Lee, you know, who's not up for re-election right now, he positioned himself as the grown up in the room, if you will. And said no. It's one thing to show concern about what happened here, but this man has also stabbed somebody earlier in the evening, and we're gonna have a day of remembrance for that. Maybe so that was an interesting political moment for Ed Lee to position himself like that. And now it's gone national. At the Super Bowl last night, Beyonce was the halftime act. And one of the halftime acts, and one of her dancers, backup dancers, had sort of held up a sign in honor of Mario Woods. And so this has become even more national. This is falling in line with all the other police shootings of African Americans around the country. It's in that very horrible pantheon right now. And so this is going to continue. The FBI is looking into that. I'm sorry, the Department of Justice is looking into this. And so this is not going away, and it shouldn't, because this is stuff that goes on all the time. And so that politics, the Mario Woods Day, is a local political issue, whereas the larger issue is the way the police behave in certain communities in this country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Deborah, do you agree?
I've seen the videotape. It's upsetting. But he did stab somebody, and he had a knife. And I understand why people, looking at other examples, would like to see something different. I wish that the police had been able to use tasers. We know that the beanbags didn't work. I think Ed Lee, there's a reason why City Hall people picked Ed Lee to be the mayor, and it's because for something like this, he understands that you can't just... I think it's a good thing the federal government is looking at this case, because we'll let the investigation tell us what more there is to know.
Mm-hmm. And the tasers are an interesting point, because the more the progressive wing in the city has said, well, no, we don't want tasers. We're here, this might have been a case where you might have saved someone's life, yeah, if police officers were able to use tasers. So that discussion will resurface too, or has resurfaced.
Okay. I think this, let me just add this final point. I think this is actually bringing to the surface a larger issue in San Francisco, in that San Francisco is becoming less diverse as a city county, particularly when compared to the surrounding counties around us here, which are becoming more diverse. And so we have this kind of unusual thing, and it's largely driven by the housing costs. It's kind of driving people out into the surrounding communities. But it's an issue that I think San Francisco is going to have to grapple with a lot more, is this the racial issue, because the way that the city demographics are kind of changing rather rapidly, mm-hmm, actually. So, and that's been a reverse. I mean, it was getting very diverse and then it kind of stopped in the early 2000s, and has really kind of changed trends. So it'll be interesting to watch how the city handles that, because they haven't had to handle stuff like this like a Chicago or a New York has had to in the past, necessarily so.
Very good. Deborah J. Saunders, I don't know if you know, she is week to week's official marijuana correspondent. So I wanted to ask her, there have been some recent moves by Governor Jerry Brown, some appointments and such.
Okay, I just find medical marijuana on BART, okay? I was writing BART last week, and I'm sitting next to this woman, I'm thinking, I smell marijuana smoke. Nah, I'm wrong. And then she got up, and after she'd left the train, I looked over, and there were a couple of medical marijuana cigarettes, and so I got to post them for a blog. that's what that was. But Joe is really our medical marijuana correspondent. It's not just politics.
This is my subbeat.
Yeah.
But we now have a medical marijuana chief in the state who is a Republican. I don't remember her name, but
Ajax.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And she is the marijuana advocates in the state are actually kind of happy about this. They wanted someone who was first of all the position's informally called the weed czar. And unfortunately it's Bureau of Medical Marijuana Research, and so the funny this acronym is the chief bummer. That's the job. So they wanted someone who was a bureaucrat. They wanted someone who is who was not from the medical not from the marijuana industry writ large, and they were happy that she's a woman, and she's a Republican, which is they don't really care. But the reason they wanted those things is because the folks. You know, the growers and the dispensary owners and such, they crave legitimacy. Mm-hmm. And so that's why they like this person, because and she came from the Department of Alcohol or the ABC. I always forget what that stands for.
Alcoholic Beverage Control.
And so she knows state bureaucracy. This is sort of going to be the department is run somewhat in the same way in how it licenses marijuana businesses, and she also has some of her turf was in the northern part of the state, which is including the Emerald Triangle of counties.
Isn't there like one of the five parts of California weed?
What? Okay. So there's three counties where like 60% of the marijuana consumed in the United States is produced and grown. So she's her early raves for her as a pick. We'll see what happens. It's an interesting job because you rarely get to create a new state bureaucracy in Sacramento. And she's hired. It's the kind of a wonky job. You hire 40, 50 people and regulators and stuff like that. So, but yes.
Okay, let's do a quick lightning round. So short answers here before we get to our news quiz. What do you think about San Francisco supervisors' possible changes? So we already know over this past year, and for those of you outside of San Francisco, welcome to our world. There was a big election that in one of our districts, so the balance of power more or less shifted a bit to the progressive side on our board. That position is up for re-election again in November, I believe. So it was just a one-year filling out of a term. But there are other things that are happening in the local soups. Any comments on the shift of that? The possible shift, will the progressives get stronger? Will the power shift back to, the so-called moderate side? I mean, Carson, you talked about these really important issues the city has to deal with.
Yeah.
Can it deal with it being that evenly split? Narrowly split, I should say.
It depends on the issue. I mean, there are a lot of issues that kind of don't break down neatly into mm-hmm. the progressive and slightly less progressive. It's not really a moderate wing in San Francisco. moderate by San Francisco standards, maybe. But there's a lot of issues that shouldn't, let me say, that shouldn't break down along those lines, development being one of them. But right now it's hard to kind of tell because it does look like they are breaking down along those lines, yeah. Which they shouldn't be, because I think progressives and strong progressives should both be kind of looking for solutions to the housing crisis in this city, and development's the only way out of it. So,
okay. How serious? No, this could go on for an entire hour, so let's keep this short. How serious is the Hillary Clinton email scandal? Chances of an indictment?
Wow.
Do we have any?
I have to tell you personally. I hope there is no indictment. I just don't feel that the criminal justice system is the proper place for this. But it's a really serious issue because it really goes to the judgment thing. Just as why, if you're running for president, do you take $675,000 from Goldman Sachs? Why do you have a private server? So, I mean, I understand that the FBI is investigating. We know that for sure. And they only investigate criminal things. This isn't this little security check that they're doing, as Hillary likes to put it. This is serious. The idea that you are going to be Secretary of State and set up your own private server shows such a rash disregard for process. For the, you know, she doesn't own that information. The American people own it. The American people are supposed to have access to it. So I think over time, and there's going to be this slow leak of things that will come out that will tell us things that were classified that ended up there. And people will be scratching their heads because we still don't know what it is. You know, you'll hear that, you know, an asset's name came out, but it's not clear. But it's really the overall fact that she decided that this is something that she could do in complete disregard for how things are supposed to be done.
Now, and this doesn't involve private email servers, but it does involve private email. Recently, it came out that, what was it, Condoleezza Rice's
and Colin Powell.
And Colin Powell's private email had also handled stuff. And in all these cases, I believe it was where emails were later said, oh yes, or they said, you know, yes, those should be top secret. A, does that help her? Or B, does that just underline the whole thing of, this is very important and everyone has to get on board and use the government email system, which can only be hacked by Russia and China.
But she set out by doing the private server, this was a deliberate way to get around the whole process. And I mean, the fact that she deleted 30,000 emails, a decision that she made, this is something that nobody else can do. And so, again, I just think that the lack of respect for the American people's right to have someone be able to look into this and see what happened, it's a disqualifier.
Politically speaking, it seems like the Democratic voters aren't really too concerned with it. But politically speaking,
Donors are,
yes. But it doesn't seem like the voters are quite yet. Politically speaking, though, what it does is it reinforces this aura of Clintons are above the law, they do their own thing, they're shady, they're not transparent. And that's the worst thing you can possibly do as a politician, is to reinforce the negative persona that exists around you. Mitt Romney kept on doing it, and I think this is what the email situation is really doing for Hillary right now.
Okay, on that happy note, let's go to our news quiz. For those of you who've been here before for this, you know how it goes, but I'll explain it to the newbies. I'm going to ask a question. Please raise your hand if you think you know the answer. I'll call on you, and you can then shout it out. And if you win, Fran will deliver a chocolate prize. If you win one, please sit on your hands and let someone else win again later in the program.
John, should this gentleman in the front get one just because he knew there was a debate on Thursday?
Yeah.
The only person in the room.
You know, Joe is the referee for the quiz.
For people who
Joe
are cheating. We've got to draw a line here somewhere. You know? I'm sorry. Okay.
Trying to help
question.
You out, brother.
Who was Senator Bernie Sanders referring to when he said, quote, I have heard about it, it's disgusting, look, we don't want that crap, unquote?
Oh.
Did any of you see this? Saw a hand there? Yes?
No, you know what, I withdraw my hand.
Okay. Anybody want to guess? He said, quote, I have heard about it, it's disgusting, look, we don't want that crap, unquote. In the back. No, it does not. Ma'am, did you want to guess? No?
Wasn't it in response to a question about, you know, Clinton's, you know, indiscretions?
It was not. And I saw a hand back there first, so, sir? That is correct. Give that man some chocolate.
There we go.
So-called Bernie bros. These are Sanders supporters who are posting sexist anti-Clinton comments and bullying Clinton supporters online. So Sanders doesn't want that. Next question. Taking advantage of low prices, President Obama proposed a new tax on what? In the red, sir. Oil, that is correct. He's proposing a $10 a barrel tax to pay for transportation projects. Next question. Even though he dissed Congress members as, quote, idiots, unquote, in a tweet, the so-called pharma bro, that's Martin Shkreli, has disavowed a tweet from his account. That tweet endorsed somebody for president. Who was the endorsement for? This guy says, I didn't actually do it, but it went out. Did anyone see this? Way in the back there? No. Nope, not Trump. Anyone else want to guess? Nope, not Cruz. Nobody?
Sanders.
Nope, nope. It was Jeb Bush. Shkreli says his date actually posted it. So, I don't know. He met her on Tinder or something.
His date?
Okay, yeah. Next.
He got a date.
Who is a Chicago police officer suing for, quote, extreme emotional trauma, unquote, right over there. That's right. He's suing the family of the young man he shot and killed in December. Next question. Why has Bart offered to pay someone $10,000? Yes. Very good. Right here in the second row, they're offering a $10,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of the person who shot and killed a BART rider on January 9th. Right over there. That one's too easy. I'm not going to give that one to you. Okay, a Washington state judge ruled that a man who killed his wife could not get what? Yes. That's right. He could not get her pension. They had to spell that out, apparently.
That's good knowledge.
Okay, just a few more. Hillary Clinton took a break from New Hampshire campaigning to travel to what city in crisis?
Oh, look at this.
I'm going to go with the gentleman with the Flint, Michigan. That is right. Okay.
Better than Ben Carson.
Evangelical Wheaton College in Illinois has parted ways with Professor, I hope I'm not pronouncing her name incorrectly, Larisha Hawkins over what? What did Professor Hawkins do, ma'am?
She spoke out about that Christians and Muslims worship the same God, and she wore hijab.
Very good. She had said that Christians and Muslims worship the same God, and she wore hijab, excuse me. To show support for women, Muslim women facing harassment. So let's do one more. Gung Hei Fat Choi, by the way. Happy Chinese New Year, folks.
All right.
Now, it would be too easy if I were to ask you what year this is going to be in the Chinese zodiac. It's the year of the monkey. So what year was it last year, according to the Chinese? Yes, sir. That's right. Sheep or lamb or goat. Right there.
Okay.
Well, let's do one more. Just because I want to. In a pre-Super Bowl interview, President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama, they admitted they were just like the rest of us because something doesn't work in the White House. What doesn't work there? Sir, I saw your hand first.
Wi-Fi.
The Wi-Fi does not work.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, everybody. We're going to be back with more news quiz questions, of course, and much more to discuss Monday, March 7th here in San Francisco.
Yeah.
To find our week-to-week news quiz every week on Huffington Post. Thank you to our panel, Deborah J. Saunders, Joe Garofoli, and Carson Bruno. Thanks to all of you here, watching and listening online. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.